All right. Hey, welcome everybody to the Chariot Tech Chat Tuesdays. We set up this name so I can screw it up every single time. I am Ken Rimple, the host, and I'm joined by Keith Gregory from Chariot Solutions and Matt Gilbride from Chariot Solutions. Gentlemen.
Hey.
Ahoy.
All right. Take it away. No, I'm just kidding. So today we have kind of a Chariot blog and Chariot content focused version of the Tech Chat Tuesday, specifically because we have a fair amount of content today. We're also going to feature a fair amount of AWS topics and cloud topics today. So we'll just kind of take it from there. If you want to leave any kind of messages or comments and maybe ask us questions along the way, feel free to put them in the chat on YouTube. We'd love to respond to them. And if you don't do it right away, we'll look at them periodically when we put this thing live permanently about a day later. So our topics today are going to focus a lot on content from Chariot's blog. If you go to chariotsolutions.com, the quick shortcut is /blog, but we have that hiding in resources blog, and we have a lot of content there. Tons and tons of stuff across a lot of different technologies in our blog, because we are solutions providers and developers across the full stack. And in data science and other things as well. So I should say data movement and things like that. So, and mobile, et cetera, I could go on. But let's start off, talk a little bit with Matt Gilbride first. So Matt, welcome back to the podcast. And we have a discussion around the CDK, which is Amazon's API for provisioning. So can you give us an idea? I mean, if anyone's worked with Amazon, the primary ways that people do things in Amazon are unfortunately directly in the console. And then in many cases in CloudFormation, YAML or JSON scripts, which kind of provision things, or in Terraform, which is kind of a third party provisioner. But what is the AWS CDK?
Sure. Well, first of all, shameless plug, Ken. I think we have some other AWS Chariot related news this week.
That's true.
Do we not?
Do tell. So, I just want to hear you say it.
That's about so. Ken, it was just certified as a, you are a certified cloud. It was a practitioner, or was
solutions architect, associate. So yes, I just passed that this morning. So thank you very much.
All right.
It doesn't hurt, does it?
Yeah.
It would have been a different version of the podcast had I failed it this morning. It would have been a lot more dour and so. Yeah. So thank you. I appreciate that. All right. So anyway, you were going to talk about the CDK.
Yeah. So the CDK, I believe, came out almost exactly a year ago, maybe a little more than a year ago. And I think Keith was the one that, you know, mentioned something in our internal chat about it. So it kind of piqued my interest. And I had just luckily had a personal project that involved kind of on-prem infrastructure where the premise and on-premise was my basement and kind of a rat's nest of wires and a very old laptop that finally kicked the bucket. And I decided rather than buying another, you know, cheap piece of hardware, I said, let's use this as a learning opportunity, you know, in the AWS space. And being a, you know, I'm an application developer myself, full stack, but, you know, I am not a site reliability engineer. So the DSLs of CloudFormation templates and even Terraform are a bit unwieldy for me. The CDK, kind of like an SDK, is a development kit where you can provision AWS infrastructure with regular code or with code in a general purpose programming language. I believe to date, Keith, correct me if I'm wrong, they're supporting TypeScript, JavaScript, Python, Java, and C#.NET. And I don't know if they've added any more since last I looked.
Those are the ones I remember.
But those are a lot of languages that are in use in at the application level by a lot of different places, right? And the nice thing about the CDK is that now I get to kind of reason about my infrastructure and think about organizing my infrastructure the same way I reason about other code that I'm familiar with and using patterns that I'm familiar with, and more importantly, using kind of higher level programming language abstractions that really aren't available in like a templating language, right? So everything that is in the Java language, if you want to deploy your resources with Java, is at your disposal. And the article is kind of about, you know, how big of a deal I think that is, albeit, you know, with the caveat that the CDK, even after a year, is still very new and very full of breaking changes. So I could go on and on, but my I would say non-trivial, you know, at-home security system is all deployed via the CDK, and it was lovely to work with. Figuring things out with real interfaces in a programming language rather than through the CloudFormation documentation was a heck of a lot easier.
Yeah, so just to kind of, as we're talking through this, you know, your CloudFormation template looks, and this is the JSON version, but this is what it looks like it could be YAML too. So it's a lot of like indented properties, and you certainly can have, you know, input parameters and outputs and things like that, but it's very declarative, COBOL-y kind of stuff. And then, you know, your CDK interaction is all code.
It's just code. Yeah. It's, you know, for application devs, it's very familiar, but also for, I think even for SREs, it just provides the ability to establish patterns in a more powerful way.
I used something similar, predecessor of CDK, that used Ruby to basically build up CloudFormation templates a few years ago. And this was for a project where we were deploying, I'm going to say on the order of 50 different Kube consumers plus our main web app. And what it was really nice for, I thought, is that you could boil down the ideas. So just what changes. So for example, queue number one, you want to have a visibility timeout of 30 minutes because it takes a while to process. Actually, that's, I think, too high a number. Queue number two, 1 minute. And you could just have a very simple configuration file, feed that into the program, and the program can generate the CloudFormation.
Right. How much of this is up to date with, because so my biggest question whenever they release a new provisioning API, or something like that is like, do they keep it up to date with new features? Keith, do you know anything about that or Matt, either of you?
I mean, Keith and I actually, Keith had to give me some help specifically a month ago over, so, you know, in EC2, if you want to kind of run a script to say install something or set something up when you spin up an instance, there are two ways to do that via what's called user data or a CloudFormation init script, I believe is the right term. Mm-hmm. And Keith can probably explain much more eloquently than I can why CFN init is typically recommended, but it is not supported yet by the CDK. And there has been, you know, an open issue out there on the CDK's GitHub now for over a year asking when it will be supported. So that's an example of kind of the warts where there are things that you just can't do yet. Now, the CDK does kind of give you an escape hatch to kind of write a class and define how you'll generate the JSON or the YAML that is the underlying CloudFormation template. But there's a lot of things that can go wrong there. I'd ask Keith to maybe elaborate.
Right. So one of the things about CloudFormation, and I don't think you mentioned this, Matt, but CDK is basically a way to produce CloudFormation.
Correct.
And one of the things about CloudFormation is it's all table driven. And I think probably the entire Amazon API, there is available publicly, I can't tell you where because I haven't looked at it in a long time, basically a resource specification that tells you for everything like an EC2 instance, what are the properties that go into it. And that's used to drive CloudFormation's ability to interpret a template. I believe it's used to drive the actual SDKs for the various languages that AWS uses. And also, I'm sure, to kind of build up, you know, if you look at what's on the screen right now, you're defining an EC2 instance with a bunch of properties, including the VPC, volume size, so on and so forth. I believe all of those property names are defined in this core API specification that Amazon uses. So it should, long-winded way of getting here, but it should track pretty closely to as new features are available and added through the into the API. Now, where that gets a little bit strange is things like the metadata and the CFN init metadata doesn't quite follow the API. It's something that CloudFormation interprets on its own, I think. I know. And so you have to kind of do an implementation effort to make that work. There are also some other things. You know, one of the things that I liked when I first tried out CDK is the idea that you could just go out to your environment and get information about your environment. So you know what account you're running in. You know what roles are there. You can pull that together, for example, to reference a managed policy or a role within your current account. And it's very easy to do that. And they give you some tools to help you with that.
One good example at the end of this article, you know, just kind of piggybacking off what Keith just said about, you know, leveraging things that are your in your environment is also the fact that, you know, the CDK, since you're now working in your general purpose language, means that you can use the SDK as well. So one example at the bottom of this article is one thing that's actually quite annoying, I find, when provisioning S3 buckets specifically, is that you cannot destroy an S3 bucket that has objects in it via CloudFormation. You have to go in and manually empty it first. Now, there's a reason for that, because it's obviously very dangerous to delete things out of an S3 bucket if you're not being careful. But especially when you're iterating on a new set of infrastructure, like very shortly after you spin up an S3 bucket, you're probably putting things in it. And if you're iterating, you very frequently are like, oh no, now I have to go in manually in the console and delete things out of it before I can actually destroy this stack, because the stack destroyer will fail if there's things in the bucket. Or the bucket will be orphaned, but then when I try to create the stack again, there'll be a bucket with the same name, and then recreating the stack will fail. Mm-hmm. This is a long-winded way to say that with the CDK, I can now put a little script into my deployment that says, before you run the destroy, empty the bucket with the SDK, which is really nice. It's quite handy.
Yeah, that is a really nice feature, actually. Yeah. I can see that being really useful.
Yeah.
Cool. All right. Yeah. So this is the blog post, and this is your doggie. We love your dog.
That was so cute. That was 18 months ago now, probably. She's big. She's right here.
Oh, you got her. There she is.
Sleeping. There she is.
We're maxing, relaxing. Good Emmy.
Good girl, buddy.
You know, it's funny. You were going to put Baby Yoda up, and we're like, oh, we can't put real Baby Yoda up. And like, what about the dog? I'm like, yes, the dog.
Yes.
Like a radar. Yeah. Installation. Also, you have this up on GitHub, is it correct or no? No, you don't.
Yeah, towards the top there, you'll see that if you want to run ZoneMinder, which is the open source, you know, camera, like home security software.
There it is.
That's ZoneMinder itself. And if you scroll up a little further, I think the second heading in this article.
Okay.
Somewhere there, there's a link to the GitHub repo where it is ever changing. In fact, as a follow-up on Cherry Day, I may be...
well, it's in the code. There it is, TLDR.
There it is. Check out the project on GitHub. There
GitHub.
It is.
Yes.
You know, the way that I'm deploying this particular solution today is probably more expensive than it needs to be, even though it includes more interesting AWS infrastructure. And there are some interesting bits that I could use to reduce that cost. So a follow-up will be coming one day when I find the time to get around to
optimizing that cost by refactoring some things. Yeah. Cool.
Yeah.
All right. Awesome. Thank you, Matt. Let's move on now to another topic. So, Keith, you have a two-part blog article, which tells me there was a lot involved in talking about this topic. So you were looking at something we were working through on another project, which is working with RDS database authentication. And the last project I had was a Spring Boot project, and I know we were looking at Secrets Manager for some things and using it, but this is specifically around managing password, or at least managing authentication with Secrets Manager, and hopefully dealing with rotating of secrets and things like that.
Yeah, so you know, the problem, and we ran into this problem on a couple of projects, is that Spring Boot's an example, but really anything where you're configuring your database connections. Generally, you start up an application and it reads something, say an environment variable, to get the host name, username, password for its database connections, which works in most cases. Where it starts to have some problems is, number one, if you're rotating database credentials, which is a really best practice to rotate your credentials so that someone gets hold of them, they're only usable for a short amount of time. And the other problem is, if you're using something like Aurora or Aurora Serverless, your host name might change, right? And Aurora tries to kind of work around that a little bit using DNS, so you don't necessarily worry about it. But getting the basic idea is getting your connection information at the time you make a connection, not at the time your application starts up. So it lets your application basically run continuously. And yeah, you might end up with a stale connection that gets thrown away, you get a new one. So two approaches to this. One is AWS Labs, which is a cool site on GitHub. It's basically AWS people producing open source stuff. AWS Labs has a set of database drivers that will do exactly this. And they'll go out to Secrets Manager. And if you scroll down just a tab there, just a bit on your previous page.
Oh, I'm sorry, I didn't mean to do the URL format.
So it fits in really well with Spring Boot. You just say your Spring data source URL is JDBC Secrets Manager instead of JDBC, and then pass in the stuff that doesn't change, like the host name, the port, and the default database. And it will go out and grab the secret, the username and password, out of Secrets Manager, which is nice. Has a few limitations. If you're using Secrets Manager, it's perfect. And I, by the way, like Secrets Manager. I especially like Secrets Manager in CloudFormation because you can create the secrets and nobody ever needs to see them. And then part two of that was kind of digging in, because for me, a much more interesting way of limiting the blast radius of credentials is that you can configure RDS, Postgres, and RDS MySQL to use IAM to generate a password that's only valid for 15 minutes. So you basically, you go out to IAM, you put in your IAM credentials, and it gives you a password for the database, which is really, really nice in terms of reducing blast radius, but a real pain to actually implement for something like Spring Boot. So with part two, I dive in a lot deeper and show you how you would basically create a subclass of your standard database driver that goes out and grabs the password at the time you make a connection. So two interesting things. They apply mostly to Spring Boot, because one of the things that Spring Boot does is it has a lot of magic happening, so that you can have a 10-line configuration file and suddenly have your whole ORM fired up and talking to the database. So it's a little bit more challenging than, like, if you're writing, you know, Python code where you explicitly get the password, where you can explicitly or get the connection. So, yeah, looking at that, I don't know. I don't think we ever, we stayed with that project that kind of prompted that. I believe we stayed with the passing the database credentials in as environment variables. But should we take another pass at that project, maybe we start to integrate this.
Great. Awesome. All right. Couple other things going on. So, we had another thing that you did, Keith. You did an interview with a 15 Minutes With series that we do. And a quick plug for that. We're trying to get exposure for a lot of our consultants with solutions they've worked on or technologies they work with, and kind of try to put them in terms that, you know, managers or architects with less day-to-day coding experience can take a look at and kind of get up to speed. It's called 15 Minutes With. And so if you go to the blog and you look at any one of these, you can see a whole bunch of these. In fact, let's see what we have here just as a smattering. So we've got data pipelines with Andrew Ganim. We've got mobile strategy with the Vice President of Mobile Engineering at Comcast. We've got accessibility for life science, Don Coleman on property technology and IoT. So it's kind of a lot of higher level or discussions that you can do in a shorter period of time on a specific topic. And you did one with Drew on some DevOps work. So tell me a little bit about that interview that you did.
So this is for a client of ours that is building a new application, and they're deploying in the cloud, and they wanted to be cloud agnostic. So, excuse me. The approach that we took is to use Kubernetes to do our deployment. And Drew is one of our Chariot consultants. He is focuses on DevOps. So he was the person who really implemented most of the Kubernetes environment and configuration via Terraform. And so we dove into that and talked about some of the challenges that he had, especially some of the interesting challenges of working, Kubernetes is cloud agnostic, except that Kubernetes is always running in a particular environment, in this case, an Azure environment. And there are certain challenges to, for example, accessing the Azure Secrets Manager, setting up your network connections on Azure so that you can deal with the Azure database. So we talked through that a little bit. And again, the main driver for Kubernetes was that the client wanted to be cloud agnostic. And most of our app is completely cloud agnostic, can run on Azure, AWS, Google Cloud Platform. What's funny is that today we were talking about some architectural changes. We have a component of the project that really, really should be deployed using a message queue. And my feeling on this is that I don't want to have anything in Kubernetes that has to manage persistence. Now, I firmly believe that containers are great because of the idea that they go away and you don't miss them. Whereas a message broker, if it goes away, you very much miss it.
Yeah, just a bit.
We ended up with the conversation, and the obvious solution to this was using the Azure queues. Azure Service Bus was another possibility because it has an AMQP interface, and AMQP is a standard, except most of the world is AMQP 0.9, Azure Service Bus is AMQP 1.0. The challenges of doing an agnostic architecture. At any rate, it turned out that faced with the obvious best solution to the particular problem, the client said, yeah, you know, we're using Azure queues ourselves in this other part of the architecture, so just go for it. We're okay with making that commitment. So I think that kind of leads into your next talk, which is the next thing you want to talk about, which is cloud agnosticism and multi-cloud strategies, and one of my favorite podcasters.
Yes. So we have this interesting conversation from Corey Quinn. Corey Quinn is a character. First of all, that is not Corey Quinn, just a quick note. But Corey Quinn is a podcaster and analyst and consultant for AWS stuff. What's it called? A cloud economist is his term, I think is the term he uses for himself, which is kind of great. And he had a post, and of course now, of course, I've lost. Oh, there it is. Whiteboard confessional. Well, that's not the right one.
No, nope, that's the follow up on the Steve Yeagy post.
Right, that's a different one.
He had a post about multi cloud a few weeks ago.
That's right. That's right. So the multi cloud one was trying to, and this is in his list of podcasts. And let's see if I can do this on the fly here. The dulcet tones, Corey Quinn. Corey, you're getting free advertising, apparently. I will not be able to find this fast enough. But bottom line, he had a podcast about multi-cloud being basically not something realistic that people do much with. Because a lot of things that you build that are going to be generic enough for multi-cloud don't take advantage of the cost savings and the features of the individual cloud architectures. And also, not all clouds are built the same. So I'm going to actually jump to the first one first, which is Whiteboard Confessional, Google's deprecation policy. So first of all, speaking of different clouds and the way they deal with things, AWS itself, one of the things that Corey had talked about on this podcast was that AWS rarely ever turns off anything. They're saying there's like the original AMIs. SimpleDB was there. The original classes for some of the EC2 instances are still there. They were going to turn off SimpleDB or something, and they were basically directly contacting the last few people that were using it, or it was Bigtable, I think. And they were contacting the last couple developers who were still using it, saying, can we move this thing? Can you move your code to something else? We'll even help you. So that is Amazon's ways. They may not advertise it anymore. They might like put it in a small corner and never admit to it in public, but it's still going to be there. And there might still be support for it, most likely will be still support for it if you paid for support. On the other hand, Google takes a different approach. And so Google's approach seems to be, according to them, and I don't have direct experience, is that when they are changing their APIs, they put out a note saying, this is going away within, let's say, a year, and you better switch over to something else or else. Tell me what that does to a project that does a lot of you know, code against Google Cloud Platform. Isn't that going to be a nightmare? Could be, right?
So, hey, I don't know about you, but I still resent Google for killing Reader and Picasa.
And Inbox.
Yeah.
What was their social media? They were trying to be Twitter or something. What was the thing they created for a while?
Well, there was Google Plus.
Google Plus.
Yeah. That was trying to be Facebook. I think they killed Reader so that people would be forced to use Plus. But yeah,
this is a challenge, right? I mean, so not all cloud, point being, and even though, yes, we are an AWS vendor and consultant, but we also work with a lot of other technologies. And so I don't want to hide any kind of maybe implicit bias of using something. But at the same time, you want to take a look at a solution and make sure that, you know what the change footprint is going to be over time, that it's going to affect your development team. If you built something and then you moved on to the next project and you find out deep into the next project that something's going to go away in 3 or 4 months and you don't have another team to work on it, that's a real problem. So just keep an eye on what you're using. If you're going to go down the road with Google, make sure you're researching things that you know are very highly adopted, that, you know, do the research you can. This all came from Steve Yeagy having an article about that policy, which was, "Dear Google Cloud, your deprecation policy is killing you." And it starts with a very off-color start. I didn't want to blog again. I have so much stuff to do. And Steve Yeagy is a guy who worked at Amazon and then worked at Google, is doing independent stuff now, and has some great blog posts when he writes things. He had like Something or Other in the Kingdom of Nouns, which was a famous one about, you know, REST versus non-REST architectures and things like that. And so he's just a really interesting developer and a great writer. So if you want the background for this particular missive from Corey Quinn, that's where it came from. And then another one that I had as I was looking at his Last Week in AWS podcast, which was interesting. I was thinking about this, actually. Cloud repatriation isn't a thing. So the concept of cloud repatriation is that you've had services in the cloud. Maybe you've been burned. Maybe you didn't allocate them with the right savings of cost. Or maybe, you know, it's something that doesn't quite fit the right way for your organization. And you take the stuff back into your organization again. I don't know of many companies doing that. I don't see every company, because if I did, well, I don't think I'd be working anymore because I could just take money from anything. But the bottom line is you don't see, right? I mean, hey, if you got the power, office space, a couple fractions of a cent. But you know, I don't know that this is really a big thing. I do know that there are some hardware vendors that are trying to create cloud class, servers out there. And I can't remember the one that I was looking at recently, but basically building servers that have like the scalable backplane and you could run locally in your own data centers. But that's an interesting one to hear, because he kind of goes through a lot of, you know, information about like, you know, what he sees out there and the fact that he isn't seeing a lot of people doing this, number one. Do you have any thoughts on this, either of you guys?
Well, you know, I've seen a number of companies actually talking about building, or heard of, because it's always friend of a friend situation.
Right.
Building out their internal cloud solution. And my general feeling on that is if you can't spin up 10,000 CPUs within a short time, you don't have a cloud.
Yeah, right. That makes sense.
That's largely one of the big benefits I see with going to any cloud provider, is that you don't have to care about your machine cycles. I worked with a company a few years ago that was getting to the point where putting in the capital budget to replace their machines and the engineering budget to be able to cleanly transition between machines, they decided, yeah, it doesn't make sense to do it, move it out to the cloud. And I can't imagine them ever coming back. There's also, you know, a lot of challenges to even moving between clouds. And Corey talked about this a few weeks ago. with the multi-cloud fallacy. But once you get data in, if you think about it, it's free, for example, to get data into AWS. Right? You can upload terabytes of data into S3. And it's free if you're moving that data from S3 into an EC2 instance for processing, and you get really high bandwidth to do it. If you pull down a terabyte back into your data center, that's $90 for that terabyte, $900 for 10. It really adds up. Moving your database, it's really easy, for example, with MySQL especially, to basically replicate yourself into a cloud provider. And it's a lot more challenging to replicate yourself out. So I don't know where I was going with that, but I think it's not a thing because, number one, you don't really get the savings. You forget, and especially if some of your ops people have changed roles or left the company, you forget how much work it is to manage the systems yourself. And then it's like a Roach Motel. Data goes in, but it doesn't come out if you're using a cloud vendor. So
great. Okay, yeah, but I recommend listening to him if you want a kind of an alternate view out there and a view from a practitioner that's not necessarily hooked up with a vendor as much as being the vendor. There are some really good AWS resources, but giving it a third party opinion out there. Last Week in AWS, Screaming from the Cloud are a pretty good podcast to listen to there. Realizing it's an external view, so if you want an alternative, that's a good one to look at. All right. And I'm just busy feverishly posting our links in here in the chat, so we have them. But other than that, I appreciate both of you having time for us today. I really do appreciate it.
Well, thanks always so happy much. To be on. Thanks.
Awesome. All right, guys.
One side note on the CDK, not to jump in at the end here.
Hey, why not?
If you can comment or not, is that I'm just posting this article. I don't know if you want to. That's from HashiCorp. I put it in the private chat if you want to put it out there publicly.
Sure,
Ken is
sure.
Very quickly, their response to the Amazon CDK now is that they have a CDK for provisioning Terraform assets via either Python or TypeScript. So I think this type of thing is going to grow.
The IDEs themselves, right? Having that code fill in from the SDK, itself being able to introspect them to do the code fill in. It's been difficult, I think, for the plugins for YAML and JSON, because it's not the same as updating from a language. It's automatic once you get the updated SDK.
Yep.
Yep. So that's a really good point.
Yeah, it is an interesting thing. One of the user groups I'm part of, I was talking to a person there who is in the ops team for a organization. And he was saying, something he's learned is that whereas he used to be responsible for creating Terraform or CloudFormation scripts for the software teams, now they do it themselves with CDK. They know what they want. They're comfortable writing, as I think, Matt, you said earlier, they're comfortable writing the code to do it.
That's great. That's really great.
Yeah, I guess you could say it might democratize infrastructure on a certain level where, now the team responsible for the API that's running on an app is now can be equivalently responsible for deploying it to a greater extent.
I think it's great when developers understand the infrastructure they're deploying on.
Right.
You turn developers loose and all of a sudden you find that your little web app is running on a cluster of a dozen 16 extra large instances that are costing,
96 cores. Come on, man.
Yeah.
So, definitely a slippery slope.
But yeah. I do think, to the extent that you can move the tools into the hands of the people who are affected by it, it's great.
Put more dev in DevOps as opposed to OpsOps. Because I'm dealing in the cloud formation stuff, sometimes I get lost. I have a hard time focusing on exactly where I am in a giant file. And they end up becoming giant files,
To expand on that, a good DevOps team that gets to know the CDK can provide their development teams with some wrappers around those constructs that put their training wheels in place, right?
Yeah.
That force them to create infrastructure the way that the DevOps team wants it to be created.
Right. Or create higher order constructs. That's one of the big benefits of the CDK. And, you know, they show the flashy demo where they bring up a complete deployment with VPC, load balancer, multiple containers, in eight lines of TypeScript code.
Right.
I'm just going to start crying here based on my last project.
Well, but there is there's a lot of work going into that TypeScript code, and you have to like the way that it comes out. You have to like what it produces. But I think a lot of DevOps team can do that level of work so that, you should be able to do deployment as an actual project team in maybe a half dozen lines of TypeScript configuration.
Now, I hope they do like the JavaScript and TypeScript and HereDoc and stuff. So if you command click your way into the library, you get some, at least a link to the documentation. But I'm guessing that's a little lacking compared to the CloudFormation docs, but I don't know. Does it tell you anything?
I believe the source is written in TypeScript itself, so you should be able, it should be fully navigable from JavaScript.
I'm going to
highlight another kind of opinion strongly held by yours truly, that you should probably be dealing with infrastructure in a strongly typed language in the first place. I'll stop there.
Yes, we know TypeScript, man.
Or Python with Typeints, or Java, or, you know,
Angle brackets can be sharp. All right. Gentlemen, thanks so much. Have a great day, and I appreciate the podcast with you today.
Talk to you next time.
Yeah.